Conclusion: How to Get the World Right. In 1802, a farm boy in South Hadley, Massachusetts, made an unusual discovery while plowing his father's fields. The boy, Pliny Mood, unearthed a stone imprinted with several large bird-like footprints. The footprints were dinosaur tracks, some of the first dinosaur tracks ever discovered. But the Mood family knew nothing of dinosaurs. They excavated the stone and placed it at their doorstep, raising speculation from the neighbors that they had been breeding some very heavy poultry. Several years later, the stone was purchased by a physician named Elihu Dwight, who spread word that he had discovered the origin of the unusual tracks, Noah's raven. Noah, according to the Bible, sent a raven from his ark to find dry land as the waters of the great flood receded. The raven never returned to the ark, apparently because it found a new home in South Hadley. Paleontologists have now identified the tracks as belonging to Anomopus scambus, a bird-like dinosaur that roamed the Connecticut River Valley around 200 million years ago. The correct interpretation of the tracks required theoretical advances in biology and geology that had yet to occur when the tracks were discovered, so Dwight relied on intuition. The tracks looked like bird tracks, so they must have been made by a known species of bird. And they looked very old, so they must have been made at one of the earliest known points in time, the Great Flood described in Genesis. This interpretation highlights several characteristics of intuitive theories discussed in the previous chapters. First, it shows how intuitive theories influence not just our beliefs about the world, but our very perceptions of the world. The fossilized footprints were each 12 inches long, much larger than the feet of a raven, but the discrepancy did not stop Dwight from seeing the footprints as left by a raven. A more reasonable guess would have been a turkey, but Dwight also had to explain why the footprints had been fossilized. The Great Flood provided such an explanation. Not only did the flood take place thousands of years ago, enough time for the footprints to have become fossilized, but it also would have left the earth muddy, and thus receptive to the footprints of a mere 3-pound bird. Dwight's interpretation of the tracks also highlights how intuitive theories are anthropocentric, grounded in a human timescale, a human perspective, and a human sense of value and purpose. His interpretation entailed a time known to humans, a few thousand years ago, a creature known to humans, a raven, and circumstances significant to humans, a flood sent by God to punish humans. A correct interpretation of the tracks, on the other hand, entails events that occurred long before humans ever existed, 200 million years in the past, creatures never observed by humans, dinosaurs, and circumstances having nothing to do with humans, a day in the life of an ancient reptile. A final characteristic of intuitive theories highlighted by Dwight's interpretation is that intuitive theories, while grounded in experience, are elaborated by culture. Dwight would never have identified a raven as the creator of those tracks if it were not for the biblical account of Noah's raven. If the biblical account were different, if Noah had sent an owl in search of land rather than a raven, or if Noah had saved the earth's creatures from a fire rather than a flood, then the interpretation of those tracks would surely have been different. Example, owl tracks imprinted in petrified ash. Scientific theories, like intuitive theories, are products of culture, and Dwight cannot be faulted for failing to identify the tracks as dinosaur tracks, because his culture had not yet formulated the notion of a dinosaur, let alone the notions of evolution, extinction, and deep time. Our ability to transcend the limitations of our intuitive theories is as much a cultural achievement as it is an individual achievement. Dwight may not have identified those tracks, but anyone, even a child living in South Hadley today, could. Science has refined and expanded human thought, allowing us to entertain ideas that previous humans had never been able to entertain before. As long as we are receptive to those thoughts and not completely blinded by our intuitive theories. The main goal of this book was to introduce you, the listener, to your own intuitive theories. Theories you held explicitly in the past, but only implicitly today, as well as theories you may still hold explicitly. The 12 intuitive theories covered in this book are not the only such theories we humans hold. We also hold intuitive theories about psychology, example, intuitive theories of knowledge and memory, and mathematics, example, intuitive models of arithmetic and rational numbers. But the 12 discussed here are rich enough and varied enough to show that intuitive theories do not fit a single mold. Each theory arises for different reasons, though some of those reasons cohere around common themes. One common theme is that intuitive theories are grounded in perception. They rest on properties that we can perceive, to the detriment of those that we cannot. In many cases, the properties we can perceive remain undifferentiated from those we cannot. Intuitive theories of matter, for instance, do not distinguish between the imperceptible property of density and the perceptible properties of heft and bulk. And intuitive theories of thermal phenomena do not distinguish between the imperceptible property of heat and the perceptible property of warmth. Other imperceptible notions absent from intuitive theories include atoms, elements, molecules, electrons, photons, forces, inertia, gravity, orbits, tectonic plates, organs, genes, cells, nutrients, embryos, germs, common ancestors, and natural selection. Intuitive theories also tend to be thing-based. They carve up the world into discrete, tangible things, whereas scientific theories carve up the same aspects of the world into processes. Heat, sound, electricity, lightning, fire, magnetism, pressure, climate, weather, earthquakes, tides, rainbows, clouds, life, vitality. These are processes, not things. They are processes that emerge from the collective interaction of an entire system of things, operating at a lower level of organization than the processes themselves. Example, electricity arises from the collective interaction of electrons. Life arises from the collective interaction of organs. Historically, the reclassification of emergent phenomena from things to processes was a critical first step in establishing several domains of science. But such reclassifications rarely permeate popular consciousness because the cognitive demands of systems-based thinking are too high, discussed in Chapter 3. Finally, intuitive theories tend to focus on objects rather than contexts. Properties that vary by context are assumed to be intrinsic to the objects that manifest them. Buoyancy, for example, is not an all-or-nothing property. Objects that are buoyant in some liquids may sink in others. Example, raspberries float in water but sink in oil. Likewise, weight varies by altitude, solubility by solvent, and color by viewing conditions. Taking context into account requires a broader perspective than that afforded by intuitive theories, because intuitive theories are concerned with what is typically true, example, bananas are yellow, not what is universally true, example, bananas absorb all wavelengths of light except those that appear yellow to the human eye. In short, intuitive theories focus more on the perceptible than the imperceptible, more on things than processes, and more on objects than contexts. Each of these themes extends to several intuitive theories, but not all. Intuitive theories differ in form and function, and it would be a mistake to try to shoehorn all such theories into a single category. Failing to appreciate the role of molecular motion in heat transfer is substantively different from failing to appreciate the role of tectonic plates in volcanism. Failing to abstract a notion of density from the perceptual experience of heft is substantively different from failing to abstract a notion of germs from the perceptual experience of contagion. Any educator who wants to help students confront and correct their intuitive theories needs to tailor his or her instruction to those theories. There is, however, at least one common thread running through all intuitive theories. They are narrower and shallower than their scientific counterparts. They are narrower in what they explain, and they are shallower in how they explain it. Intuitive theories are about coping with present circumstances, the here and the now. Scientific theories are about the full causal story, from past to future, from the observable to the unobservable, from the minuscule to the immense. Our intuitive theories of the cosmos, for example, treat the Earth as the center of the universe, but scientific theories treat the Earth as one planet among many, in one solar system among many, in one galaxy among many. Our intuitive theories of life construe bodies as structurally and functionally unified entities, but scientific theories construe bodies as collections of organs, composed of collections of cells, composed of collections of organelles, composed of collections of molecules. And our intuitive theories of ancestry place us at the apex of creation, whereas scientific theories place us on one of many branches of primates, within mammals, within vertebrates, within animals, within a vast tree of life. Intuitive theories may help us answer the small questions in life, example, what should I eat, where should I step, how can I get well? But only scientific theories help us answer the big ones, example, who are we, where did we come from, where are we going? In Chapter 1, I liken the acquisition of new knowledge to the building of new Lego creations. In the same way that many Lego creations can be built from a basic set of Lego blocks, many forms of knowledge can be built from our innate repertoire of concepts. But some forms of knowledge require new types of concepts, example, inertia, planet, germ, just as some Lego creations require new types of Lego pieces, example, wheels, axles, gears. This analogy aptly characterizes the gap between intuitive knowledge and scientific knowledge, but doesn't easily characterize how we traverse that gap, how we acquire scientific concepts. We can't just go to the concept store, down the street from the Lego store, and buy a shiny new concept. We have to acquire the new concept in increments, starting with the concepts we have and forging our way to the concepts we do not. A better analogy for this process is Otto Neurath's analogy of building a ship in the middle of the ocean, Chapter 4. Just as sailors are stuck with a particular ship once they've set sail, cognitive creatures are stuck with a particular set of beliefs once they've begun observing and interacting with the world. If the sailors realize mid-voyage that their ship is inadequate for confronting the challenges ahead, they cannot rebuild the ship from scratch. But they can restructure the ship by repurposing its constituent materials. Likewise, if we humans realize mid-development that our knowledge is inadequate for confronting the challenges ahead, we cannot rebuild the knowledge from scratch, but we can restructure our knowledge by repurposing its constituent concepts. So how do we do that? How do we restructure our own knowledge, which is constrained by our prior beliefs and our evolved cognitive capacities? When framed at an abstract level, the problem sounds harder than it actually is. It cannot be addressed at an abstract level either. To restructure our knowledge, we have to get our hands dirty in the details of the knowledge itself, the concepts that need to be differentiated, collapsed, reanalyzed, or discarded. One nice example of this dirty hands approach is a tutorial designed to help poultry farmers determine the sex of day-old chickens. Chicken sexing is surprisingly difficult. At birth, male and female chicks are indistinguishable in size, shape, and plumage. Sex-distinctive characteristics, like the comb on a rooster's head, do not emerge until several weeks after birth, at which point the hatcheries will have wasted resources on chicks that will never lay eggs, the males. Male chicks are also disruptive to the operation of a hatchery, blocking female chicks' access to food and water. It is thus an economic priority for hatcheries to sort males from females as early as possible. Doing so, however, requires examining a pin-sized structure, the chick's genital eminence, or bead, that looks virtually identical between males and females, at least to the untrained eye. Trained observers can identify the sex of day-old chicks with 99% accuracy at a rate of 2 chicks per second, but this level of proficiency requires several years of trial and error, learning at the side of an expert chick sexer. When vision scientists learned of this intriguing perceptual problem, they applied the tools of their trade, an analytic framework for distinguishing recurrent visual features from random ones, to hundreds of pictures of chick beads. They discovered that male beads do not consistently differ from female beads in size, location, texture, or segmentation, but do consistently differ in one feature, convexity. Male beads are generally rounder than female beads. The researchers then created a tutorial for teaching novice chicken sexers how to differentiate males from females by focusing on bead convexity. Their tutorial proved highly effective. Chicken sexing novices, adults who had never laid eyes on a chick's bead, let alone wanted to, were given 18 photographs of chick beads and asked to sort the photos by sex. Before the tutorial, they sorted the photos at random. After the tutorial, they sorted the photos with 90% accuracy, a rate comparable to that of experts asked to sort the same photos. The experts had an average of 3 years of chicken sexing experience. The novices, in contrast, had undergone only 5 minutes of training. Targeted training, that is, training grounded in an in-depth analysis of the relevant domain of knowledge, is thus several times more effective than unguided or minimally guided exploration of the domain, as discussed in Chapter 5. Another nice demonstration of this idea comes from research on how to teach second graders the concept of mathematical equivalence. All branches of mathematics, from arithmetic to calculus, rely on the idea that quantities can be expressed in different ways across an equation. Quantities on the left side of an equation, example 1 plus 5, must equal those on the right side, example 8 minus 2. The notation separating the two sides, the equal sign, means is the same as. Young children don't quite see the equal sign in those terms. They interpret it as a prompt to perform a computation. The equal sign in 4 plus 3 equals blank, for example, is interpreted as a prompt to add 4 and 3 and to write their sum in the space provided. Equations in which mathematical operations are placed on the right side of the equal sign, blank equals 4 plus 3, or on both sides of the equal sign, 4 plus 3 equals blank plus 1, throw young children for a loop, as these arrangements defy a strictly procedural interpretation. Math educators have long known that young children fail to grasp the conceptual meaning of the equal sign, but adults' approach to conveying this meaning is typically to give them more of the same, namely, more problems formatted as operations equal answer. The teachers assume that children must learn to solve standard problems before they can move on to non-standard problems, where a procedural definition of the equal sign does not apply. As it turns out, teaching mathematical equivalence with both standard and non-standard problems is more effective than starting out with only standard problems. In one study, researchers created two workbooks. One workbook contained only standard problems, 4 plus 3 equals blank, and one had problems with the same addends arranged in non-standard formats, blank equals 4 plus 3, 4 plus 3 equals blank plus 1. They then tested second graders' ability to answer each type of problem, standard and non-standard, after completing each type of workbook. Not surprisingly, children who practiced non-standard problems in their workbooks answered more non-standard problems correctly than did children who practiced only standard problems. But children who practiced non-standard problems also answered more standard problems correctly, twice as many, in fact. And this difference was observed even 6 months later. Both groups of children solved the same problems content-wise, but subtle differences in the formatting of these problems led to large and reliable differences in how much children learned from them. The point of this study, as well as the chicken sexing study, is not just that some study materials are better than others, it's that effective instruction requires an in-depth analysis of what concepts need to be learned and how those concepts are best conveyed. We've encountered several other examples of conceptually informed instruction throughout the book. Carol Smith's tutorial on the particulate nature of matter, Chapter 2. Micheline Chi on the kinetic nature of heat, Chapter 3. John Clement on the ubiquitous nature of force, Chapter 5. Michael Ranney on the anthropogenic nature of climate change, Chapter 7. Virginia Slaughter on the vitalistic nature of biological activities, Chapter 8. Sarah Gripsover on the metabolic nature of food consumption, Chapter 9. Ken Springer on the biophysical nature of inheritance, Chapter 10. And Terry Awe on the microbial nature of illness, Chapter 11. These kinds of tutorials have proven effective because they harness the same kind of analytic power harnessed by the chicken sexing tutorial and the mathematical equivalence tutorial. They are based on an analysis of the domain that takes what learners believe to be true of the domain and either challenges those beliefs for beliefs that are wrong, refines those beliefs for beliefs that are accurate but imprecise, or elaborates on those beliefs for beliefs that are accurate but incomplete. Effective tutorials forge a path between a learner's intuitive theories of the domain and an expert's theory. The path that is forged is rarely the only path, others are possible, but it is a path nonetheless. Forms of instruction that do not forge such paths include plug-and-chug problem sets, free exploration of micro-worlds, and unguided experimentation. Recall the failure of such approaches from Chapter 5. These forms of instruction allow students to remain absorbed in their intuitive theories and do not, therefore, challenge the theories or refine them. Also ineffective is fostering general abilities like critical analysis, quantitative reasoning, or inquiry skills, as these abilities do not address the conceptual problems inherent in an intuitive theory. Learning how to analyze a text on astronomy will not help a flat Earth theorist become a spherical Earth theorist, just as learning how to run a controlled physics experiment will not help an impetus theorist become a Newtonian theorist. Students need an explication of their intuitive theories, an explanation for why those theories are flawed, and a demonstration of how scientific theories of the same phenomena fare much better. Critical analysis, quantitative reasoning, and inquiry skills are important to develop, of course, but they are not remedies for domain-specific scientific misconceptions. By its very nature, science is a domain-specific enterprise. Specific kinds of scientists, example, paleontologists, run specific kinds of experiments, example, carbon dating, for the purpose of testing specific kinds of hypotheses, example, that one fossil is older than another, with specific kinds of data, example, differential rates of radioactive decay. Just as doing science is domain-specific, learning science is domain-specific as well. Students in specific kinds of classes, example, microbiology, must learn specific kinds of concepts, example, bacteria, RNA, mitochondria, embedded in specific kinds of theories, example, germ theory, cell theory, relevant to specific kinds of phenomena, example, fermentation, decomposition, disease. Instruction that neglects the domain-specific nature of intuitive theories and their scientific counterparts has about as much chance of working as the chance of a nuclear physicist's making an important discovery in immunology, or an immunologist's making an important discovery in nuclear physics. It could happen, but I wouldn't hold my breath. Moving from intuitive theories to scientific theories is difficult, but that difficulty is compounded by our frequent failure to recognize the limitations of our intuitive theories. These theories give us a sense of understanding, a sense that feels appropriate and sufficient, and we rarely seek to improve that understanding on our own. Consider the phenomenon of rainbows. You've probably seen several rainbows in your life. You know their shape, their colors, and the order of the colors. You know that rainbows are fleeting and can't be touched. You probably even know the conditions under which rainbows appear. Would you say that you understand rainbows well? On a scale of 1 to 7, where 1 indicates poor understanding and 7 indicates expert-level understanding, where would you locate yourself? As someone who has listened to an entire book on the limitations of our intuitive theories, you may be wary of your knowledge of rainbows, recognizing at this point that your intuitive theories of light and optics may be inadequate for capturing the true nature of a rainbow. But adults in general are not wary. They think they know much more than they actually do. If asked to rate their understanding of rainbows or any other natural phenomena, example, earthquakes, comets, tides, most adults rate their understanding as moderate, that is, a 4 on a scale of 1 to 7. If you then ask adults to write out an explanation of these phenomena, "So, tell me, how do rainbows form?" their confidence in their understanding drops from a 4 to a 3. And if you then ask a diagnostic question about their understanding, "Why are rainbows curved rather than straight? Why do the colors of the rainbow always appear in the same order?" their confidence drops from a 3 to a 2. This tendency to overrate our understanding of natural phenomena has been labeled the illusion of explanatory depth. It is the illusion that our explanatory knowledge, as grounded in intuitive theories, runs much deeper than it actually does. This illusion has been documented in people of varying ages, from 4-year-olds to 40-year-olds, and with varying levels of education, from minimal exposure to science to graduate-level training in science. It has even been documented in people who have significant first-hand experience with the domain under consideration. Example, cycling experts asked to explain the mechanics of a bicycle. As someone who holds a PhD in psychology, I qualify as an expert in the field, yet I fall prey to the illusion of explanatory depth every time I prepare a new lecture on a psychological topic. I start my preparation convinced I know enough about the topic to occupy a full hour's worth of class, but soon discover I know only enough to occupy 5 minutes' worth. My first year of teaching was one long foray into the illusion of explanatory depth. Researchers who have studied this illusion have determined that it's not just a matter of general overconfidence, on par with overconfidence in our driving ability or our financial investments. It's specific to complex causal systems, systems with multiple causal pathways, multiple levels of analysis, non-visible mechanisms, and indeterminate end states. Consequently, the illusion does not pertain to forms of knowledge that lack these properties, like procedures, example, knowledge of how to bake chocolate chip cookies, or narratives, example, knowledge of the plot of Star Wars. If you think you can bake chocolate chip cookies or recount the plot of Star Wars, you probably can. Our knowledge of natural phenomena thus suffers on two fronts, from our limited ability to explain these phenomena in accurate terms, and from our limited recognition of this limited ability. We are blind to our own blindness. Another complication in moving from intuitive theories of the world to scientific theories is that our intuitive views are surprisingly resilient. As the economist John Maynard Keynes once noted about the process of theory revision, "The difficulty lies not so much in developing new ideas as in escaping from old ones. Throughout the book, we've seen many examples of old ideas constraining our appreciation of new ones, even when we can fully articulate the new ones. In the domain of physics, for instance, adults who know that buoyancy is determined by density still have trouble discounting an object's weight when making judgments of sinking and floating. Refer to Chapter 2. Adults who know that it takes two wires to complete an electric circuit still have trouble denying that electricity could flow from an electric source to an electric device through a single wire. Chapter 3. Adults who know that two objects of different mass fall to the ground at the same rate still have trouble denying that a lead ball will fall faster than a wooden ball. Chapter 5. And remarkably, people who know that the Earth is a sphere still estimate distances between cities as if the Earth were flat. Chapter 6. We exhibit the same tendencies in the domain of biology. Adults who know that plants are alive still classify them as not alive when rushed or mentally preoccupied. Chapter 8. Adults who know that aspects of their personal identity have changed with age still deny that those aspects will change in the future. Chapter 9. Although adults know that infectious disease is spread through germs, they will nevertheless blame supernatural forces for making them sick. Chapter 11. And some adults who know that humans evolved from non-human ancestors still deny that humans are related to all organisms through common ancestry, even a lowly paramecium. Chapter 13. These findings suggest that scientific knowledge does not improve our understanding of the world as much as it complicates our understanding, adding a new layer of interpretation atop an older one. This way of thinking about conceptual change is relatively new, only being described within the last decade. Before that time, researchers interested in conceptual change tended to assume that scientific theories overwrite intuitive theories, most likely because the investigators were focused on characterizing differences between science novices, example, ninth graders, and science experts, example, physics PhDs, rather than testing the stability of those differences when experts are rushed, burdened, or distracted. Given that researchers have only begun to study this new phenomenon, there is still much we do not know. Why aren't intuitive theories erased by scientific ones? What contexts trigger intuitive theories, and what contexts trigger scientific theories? What skills are needed to recognize the difference between reasoning based on intuition and reasoning based on science? What skills are needed to prioritize science over intuition? With respect to the last question, it would seem that knowing a lot of scientific facts is not enough. We must actively think like scientists. We know, for instance, that appreciating humans' place in the biological world requires more than just knowing that species are related through common ancestry. It also requires the ability to discern patterns of genetic relatedness from the branches of an evolutionary tree. Likewise, we cannot understand the biological underpinnings of infectious disease just by knowing that germs exist. We need the ability to think of germs as living, breeding organisms. If thinking like a scientist is critical to reaping the benefits of science, then educators may need to introduce scientific ideas as methods of reasoning rather than just bodies of knowledge, as approaches to problems rather than just their solutions. Intuitive theories provide us with everyday approaches to everyday problems. That's their raison d'être, and the reason we default to those theories when rushed or distracted may be that we never learn to use our scientific theories in the same way. In graduate school, I helped teach a psychology course on cognitive development, from the development of scientific cognition to the development of moral cognition. Moral cognition was the last topic covered, and the instructor who lectured on moral cognition concluded her lecture by noting that the development of moral cognition is more socially significant than the development of scientific cognition. It matters whether your neighbor has a sense of moral virtue and treats you with moral dignity, she argued, but it doesn't matter whether your neighbor holds an accurate understanding of biology or an accurate understanding of physics. Her view was that errors in scientific reasoning are private and inconsequential, whereas errors in moral reasoning are public and impactful. That comparison struck me as wrong. It was wrong not because the instructor overemphasized the importance of moral reasoning, but because she underemphasized the importance of scientific reasoning. Our understanding of natural phenomena has widespread implications for how we act on the world and react to it. How we decide whether a surface is safe to walk on, how we decide whether an object is safe to touch, how we lift objects, how we stack objects, how we plan for an earthquake, how we plan for a flood, how we select the foods we eat, how we select the garments we wear, how we cope with aging, how we cope with death, how we interpret the results of a blood test, how we interpret the results of a genetic screening, how we avoid illness, how we treat illness, and how we treat other animals, just to name a few examples. Our understanding of natural phenomena has widespread social implications as well. Vaccination, pasteurization, stem cell research, cloning, fertility treatment, genetic modification of food, genetic modification of microbes, antibiotics, pesticides, cryogenics, space exploration, nuclear power, climate change. These science-laden issues affect society as a whole. It is important not just that scientists understand them, but that everyone understands them, as we must collectively decide what policies are needed to address these issues and what resources are needed to investigate them. Vaccination provides one of the clearest examples of the importance of collective understanding and collective action. Vaccination was pioneered by Edward Jenner in 1796 as a method of inducing immunity to life-threatening viruses, like smallpox and polio. It entails injecting dead or inactivated virus cells into the body to encourage the body's immune system to develop antibodies specific to that virus prior to infection by a live strain. If enough people are vaccinated against a particular disease, its transmission will be curtailed to the point of eradication. Measles were eradicated from the United States in the late 1990s, less than 40 years after the introduction of a measles vaccine. The disease that had once infected nearly all American children and killed hundreds of them yearly had virtually ceased to exist within America's shores. Then, in 2014, measles reemerged with a vengeance, infecting over 600 people in two major outbreaks. It reemerged not among those who were too young to receive the vaccine or whose immune systems were too compromised to receive the vaccine, but among those who had intentionally avoided the vaccine, or in many cases, among those whose parents had intentionally avoided vaccinating their children. Those parents couldn't wrap their minds around the idea of injecting their children with an inactivated virus suspended in mysterious chemicals. So they entrusted their children's well-being to nature or to God. And the result was a public health disaster. Hundreds of children suffered or even died from a problem we've known how to fix for over 200 years. Thankfully, the most recent set of outbreaks have stirred action. Laws limiting personal or religious exemption to vaccination are being passed in more and more states, and programs for educating the public on the dangers of non-vaccination are being developed in more and more communities. As the vaccination debacle illustrates, modern developments in science and technology cannot be understood on the basis of intuitive theories alone. Reliance on intuitive theories will surely undermine our pursuit of a more productive economy, a more healthful society, and a more livable environment. Bill Nye, the science guy, has argued as much from an educational point of view. He sees science denial as a threat not just to our intellectual lives, but to the well-being of society as a whole. To the grown-ups, he has argued, if you want to deny science and live in your world that's completely inconsistent with everything we've observed in the universe, that's fine. But don't make your kids do it, because we need them. We need scientifically literate voters and taxpayers for the future. We need engineers that can build stuff and solve problems. While science denial is problematic from a sociological point of view, it's unavoidable from a psychological point of view. There is a fundamental disconnect between the cognitive abilities of individual humans and the cognitive demands of modern society. Over the past 2,000 years, humans have created societies that require mastery of high-level cognitive procedures, like reading and writing, as well as high-level cognitive structures, like scientific concepts and scientific theories. Concepts and theories that were once at the forefront of scientific inquiry are now routinely taught to young children. A person ignorant of those ideas could get along just fine in societies of the past, but not in today's society. In today's society, getting by requires a basic proficiency in science as much as it requires a basic proficiency in cooking, cleaning, grooming, and mending. Our modern way of life is thoroughly dependent on science, so we must take obstacles to understanding science seriously. We must take intuitive theories seriously. We must create environments that help us become aware of those theories and craft instruction that helps us overcome them in the classroom and beyond. Intuitive theories will be with us forever, as they are reinvented by every child in every generation. Let's not let the theories we construct as children constrain the opportunities we pursue as adults. This concludes Science Blind by Andrew Stuhlman, narrated by Barry Abrams. Copyright 2017 by Andrew Stuhlman. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Andrew Stuhlman, care of Brockman Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2017 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.